Heidi, hi campers. Me again. For those of you, I've just reading the statistics from the last broadcast, which was about an hour and a half ago. I think it was four people listened live, which is nice, but some very bothersome news that I'm nonplussed by. I recorded The broadcast went out live. I was using my tablet, and somehow it's got lost, so it's not there for posterity. Which might be a good thing, but I mean the point is I got it off my chest. That's what I need to remember. But it's still a bit annoying. So what I thought is I'd come straight back on while I've got the time. It's my day off, and I do another one straight away using my iPhone. Little bit. I'm in two minds about whether or not I should repeat or go over what I did before because I don't want to appear insincere. Or it's a bit like when you write a song and then you perform it back. It's not really. It's just a rehearsal of something that is only of the moment. But I don't know. I mean, I thought it went well an hour and a half ago. So well that I'm upset that I've lost it. So I might just give it another stab. See how it goes. Probably repeat yourself a couple of times to the four people who listened before. I would suggest just don't listen now. But, you know, if you're interested enough, I'll probably do a few things that are different this time. You know, it's like Brando doing a different take. Awesome shit. So what I was talking about in the last cast was it's kind of a natural follow-on from the Kafka podcast, talking about self-awareness. The Idris Parry bit, which you will find in the introduction to the Penguin Modern Classics edition of The Castle. I admitted, I actually only read that up to a certain point. I probably read about three quarters of it, but I felt it was a very pertinent place to stop where I did stop. It was upon a line which I've since stolen for a song, which was, I'll paraphrase it, I say, sometimes I feel I'm the only one who understands the fall of man. I thought I would end it there because that is the line, I can pinpoint that line as being the moment that I almost fell off me seat reading it. It kicked me square in the heart. I've had a kind of casual interest in the fall of man for some time. I think it is, like touched upon in by Parry, the idea that Kafka often references ancient mythology, and the idea that mythology has a longevity, it has an endurance because it still speaks to the human condition. These are like parables, I guess, didactic things that we can, which is kind of how I view a lot of the books in the King James Bible, actually, as just interesting parables. And it fascinates me that a lot of them, and it's the same like yesterday when I read Parry's bit, he mentioned Rilke and he mentioned Daphne and the laurel tree. I read up on the laurel tree and Apollo, and it just strikes me how relevant these things still are. There's a reason they're parables. There's a reason they become parables. They are timeless. They are not temporally situated. They just will always apply. And I think a lot of that is in the Bible. I'm not a Christian at all, but I enjoy quite a few books of the Bible. In the same way, I might enjoy any other fiction. I don't say that as an arrogant, militant atheist by any stretch, because I can't stand those idiots either. I just get some enjoyment out of them. So anyway, the idea of the fall of man, I ended it there without, I think Parry then goes on in subsequent paragraphs to illuminate us on what Kafka meant by that. I think it's self-explanatory, though. It must be explanatory to me because it bowled me over immediately. It obviously touched upon something that goes beyond understanding goes beyond the ability to articulate or explain it. It's just something inherent, innate in me, and I guess in a lot of people, and certainly in Kafka. There I go, comparing myself to Franz Kafka. Right on. Yeats Edwards Kafka. Dunstan's Kafka. Flying the flag here. In Dunstan now. Just come from Winlaton. There's a little bit of shinfo for you. Shit information. So, yeah, The Fall of Man. What I take from that is the idea of his despair, a lot of his writing rooted, being rooted in fear and anxiety. And for me, the castle, as Parry touched upon, just bureaucracy, obstacle upon obstacle, the ladder of abstraction, things being set in your path that will convolute things, make you despair, make you completely, just make you unhappy, make for a miserable life. And these things are put up, these walls, these frames, these barriers, hurdles, fences, so forth. Things that get in the way. Pointless and useless labyrinth and just futility. So for me, it was following from that for Kafka, the fall of man being the moment where Adam and Eve were expelled from Eden for the original sin. They became aware. They suddenly recognized their naked bodies, the sins of the flesh. This is. It's just in the fabric of my life, the notion of consciousness, of self-awareness. And to me, it can be destructive, ruinous, most definitely a hindrance. As in this podcast, I've listened back to the previous casts, and there's certainly more of an ease about what I'm doing, albeit in quite a staccato. I'm still fumbling around and trying to find the words as I'm trying to express what comes to mind, and I'm trying to transfer it to the tongue instantaneously. This is an extemporaneous exercise, which is, as I've mentioned before, quite a dangerous thing. Not dangerous as in doing your ironing on your rooftop in winter. Not that kind of. I'm not a daredevil. I'm not a hero. That's not what I'm trying to say. What I mean is that there's danger for me and myself in terms of self-preservation, and in terms of your perception of me, your judgment of me, if I allow myself to be bothered by that, which I do. I really do. One of my biggest issues in life, what people think about me, which is absolutely leads to a lot of destruction. Indirectly. So, to listen back, to view some of the, I'm able to view the stats of the previous casts, and certainly when I've exported them to SoundCloud, which I think is a far more, the populace on SoundCloud far outstrips this Mixlr application I'm using, which, you know, when I'm broadcasting live, I've just had a text through a friend there, Gary. Gary, I'm doing this right now in my kitchen. And as I've just mentioned before, I did this for about an hour, 55 minutes earlier this morning. And somewhere in the technological shift, my podcast was lost. So blame Samsung Galaxy S3 for that. There is no endorsement coming up on this show for Samsung. Doing this on the good old iPhone. You never have any bother with the iPhone. Certainly not. Ask anyone with the iPhone 6. So, to get back to things, yeah, the extemporaneous nature of this, I struggle with saying things out loud, kind of suborns a finality to an opinion, to an ethos. I've touched upon, the Socratic notion of conversation eliciting a truth. I arrived at a truth I had no idea existed in a podcast that I said out loud, I'm doing this as a locum for a therapist. I didn't even realise that's why I was doing it until I said it, thought about it and realised, right, that was there somewhere in the recesses of my subconscious, and it's come to the fore, and there is a truth to that. And there is a truth, I think that it's a Platonic thing as well, you look at the Republic, they're all based in dialogues, you realise. There's a reason for that. It's the back and forth, the tete-a-tete between people, which allows often people to arrive at a truth or something. Now, I'm aware that I have a network of friends, going back to even school, a lot of which I'm quite negligible. Gary Nightingale just texted me there. There's somebody I should probably make great effort with. In truth, the guy, this podcast was set up initially just as a cheap plug for an album that I've done. There's a guy who probably, I would actually say it's a joint album. I should probably rebrand, but I'm trying to get away with it. So you'll think I'm completely extraordinarily talented, but a lot of it comes down to Gary, so there's a shout out for him there. So there's friends who I can be, but that's life, and that it's not an excuse. I don't wish to excuse it. I don't think it needs excusing. I don't need to explain myself. It's just a thing that happens. It's an occurrence. Life happens, and you get older, and commitments widen along with the gulf between you and certain people. And I could probably make more time for them. And I'm sure there's certain people out there. I've got friends. I've got a friend, Chris Gray. I know is almost campaigning, lobbying to get me pinned down to a day where we can just speak. One of my oldest friends, and it's quite ridiculous, really, that I've allowed it to get to this point. But and he's probably sitting there, if he is listening to this, whether now live or retrospectively when I upload it to soundcloud.com/MarkJamesHammond, cheap plug. He's probably thinking, all right, so you've embarked on this little project here, another one of your whims, under the proviso that you're going to, well, under the gimmick is that you wish to substitute your therapist with an intangible ether iPhone microphone thing that's going out broadcast across to however many people. Why aren't you coming to see me as a friend? And if you're extolling on the virtue of conversation, arriving at certain truths, that's why I'm here. And I'm aware of that. Don't think I'm not aware of that. But trying to explain the inexplicable again, as we discussed with Idris Parry and Kafka in the previous podcast, sometimes, why would therapists exist under that logic? We have friends. Most of us have somebody, at least, we can go and talk to. But obviously, that there are some people out there who don't, who would really need a therapist. But my point is, sometimes I can open up to a stranger with great ease, as you're probably noticing right now. I can't explain it. It's a weird paradox in me, where I can access these things with a hint. If there's just a hint of anonymity there, it's not that I struggle around friends. Certainly, I think if anything would be said about me other than I'm a card, a fop, and a fair bell end, it would be my openness. That being said, I've still solicited therapy in the past, and I'm doing this chiefly for the reason that in conversation, and this is very blunt, I don't think I've tried to articulate this before, trying to desperately explain the inexplicable here, but in conversation, sometimes people can return their opinion to you. Sometimes that can be helpful, very much so. That's kind of the point. But a lot of the time I kind of nettle at it. I'm a very irritable character. Sometimes it's quite selfish and self-involved, but I just want to get it out there and just speak at the person and say, here, have this. But then people will naturally, if they're a polite and sort of normal person, they'll try and return by way of understanding, just some sort of opinion on what you just said. It demonstrates that they're listening. It's not a bad thing, but to me, it just makes me cringe sometimes. You probably think I'm a complete wanker here, but I am just being honest. And sometimes I'll watch people react, and from the eyes will just go elsewhere. I won't switch. I'm still listening, but I'm kind of I'm going red. And I'm embarrassed because they're trying to put their own, as you do, they're trying to relate their own experience to what you've just relayed, but often it misses the mark, which is no fault of anybody's, and I'm not trying to say I'm operating on some grand, vast, intellectual field that is inaccessible to anyone else. Not at all. It's just a basic empathy and understanding thing. I think some things I say are inexplicable, and I don't even understand them, much less know how to articulate them. But sometimes we try, as in art, as in poetry, as in conversation. And we try, and people naturally, how can they get it if you don't get it yourself? Or you, there might be times I get it, but I've not explained it very well, and they try and show how they've understood it, whereas I wouldn't understand my explanation of it. So how could they? And it just makes me go, get me back up and like, oh, please, just shut up. Just take what I've said and just forget it. Like, I've got it out, that's fine. That's what this lets me do. And if you get it, if you understand my bullshit, then great. I hope it has some practical use for you. If not practical, because life isn't just about what you do, then I don't know. I don't know what I wish to achieve. I mean, a lot of my undertakings, say I used to write, this has become almost has taken the place of my more public sort of writings, for magazines and websites, because I realised with those it was in the context of, say, music review or cultural dispatch. All I was trying to do with those things, really, it was insincere. I was trying to impress people. I needed validation, acceptance, and I thought I could do that by demonstrating my intelligence, my insight, all just very insincere motives, really, all rooted in ego and id. And I'm not interested in that anymore. I want to move beyond that entirely, because it's a waste of, it's sad, it's a waste of time, and it's not earnest. And I'm only interested right now at this point in my life. I'm sure it'll shift, but right now I'm very much interested in sincerity, in trying to explain the inexplicable, trying so fucking hard. I don't do this as a means so that somebody who has the same or a similar plight can sit there and go, oh, wow, I relate to that. I don't care. That doesn't concern me. It shouldn't concern, well, it just doesn't. I mean, it might sound a bit callous or whatever. I'm just pulling the blinds up so I don't look out the window at the beautiful vista of Dunstan here. I'm doing it for my own sake, really. Literally, to help me organise thoughts in my head. I mean, that's hard enough. Organising and cataloguing thoughts in your head into some sort of coherence, and then it, from there, I mean, that is an effort in itself, but to then translate it to the tongue is another beast in itself, a huge thing. And then when it leaves the tongue and to be received by, you know, an audience, whoever that might be, might just be a friend, then if they don't get it, or they display it that they're trying to get it, but they kind of fumble it or botch it, that can be ruinous. I mean, that can lead to a lot of destruction and a lot of despair for me personally. It breeds isolation, and makes me want to withdraw within and away from everything, from all, you know, from doing anything at all. What's, you know, where is the point? It just heightens the futility of it all. Which is, it's just not how I want to live, but the sad fact is that's probably 90% of life. It is that, and it's led to, I mean, please don't underestimate the gravitas of isolation, of feeling misunderstood, of, I know I'm not trying to paint myself again as some saintly martyr, but this is just, we all have feelings, we all have things within that we don't express outwardly. And I think we don't express a lot of them outwardly because we fear how we'll be judged. Like, now I'm saying this, I fear your immediate judgment will be, oh, you know, get off. Oh, aren't you bloody special? Oh, look at you. You're on another level and above everyone. I don't think that's what it's about. It might sound like that, but there's case in point. I don't want to share it because you probably think that. But the reality and the truth of the matter is these feelings exist in me. They probably exist in a lot of us. So I'm not going to fucking hide them just because I'm scared of what you think. So yeah, the danger with certainly with an extemporaneous thing like this is that you might say something to a friend, for instance, and while we're on about friends. And I've got friends going back, and I've got a certain perception of them based off things, if not interactions and experiences we've shared, and certainly things they've said out loud, things they've tried to explain, inexplicable things, no doubt, abstractions, feelings, emotions, opinions, things about their core value system. And I realise that these are shaped a lot by what people say out loud. And that's scary, that's dangerous. And this is dangerous because, yes, it's extemporaneous, it's kind of improvised, it's out loud, but it does get recorded. Sometimes the recordings actually work and upload. Not this morning, but I got a lot of anger out in the first podcast anyway, so I'm not feeling too bitter about that, and I'm able to do it again. It's only another 55 minutes that I have to waffle on, and I can do it. You know, it's my day off, and I'm happy to do this. This is my hobby horse at the minute, so why not? So when you say things out loud, friends, I might have said something to a friend in the past, and it could be something, in the initial podcast, I pulled at hand a John Steinbeck. I think I had East of Eden at hand, and I just said, right, hypothetical example. I might have said to a friend years ago, I fucking hate John Steinbeck. Then we may never have spoken again. Now, he's walking around, if he's got a particularly sad life with nothing else going on and nothing else to think about, he might be thinking, oh, that Mark Hammond, don't like that John Steinbeck, like, what's his fucking problem, like? Good, right, I am, nice and mad in that. Well, now the thing is, I might have changed my mind the next day. One of my favourite, now you know from listening to the previous podcast, this is quite a pretentious, because me, but you know, I'm big time to Søren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, and one of his things was life is a process of becoming. He was a devout Christian, but not a fan of Christianity. Not a fan of Christendom. Hated the church and what it stood for, and the idea that spiritual matters and philosophical matters were fixed, rather than these constantly evolving, shape-shifting notions that should grow and develop every day. And the example of Steinbeck and saying that to a friend, I mean, 2 seconds later, my opinion might have grown outside of that. And I mean, it's quite a ridiculous thing, but we are open to the ridiculous in this forum, but this idea of a process of becoming has always reminded me of Bittersweet Symphony, the song. I'm a million different people from one day to the next. I think that's a great line. And I'm not going to feel self-conscious enough to go, but I don't like the verb because I'm too cool for the verb. It's just a great fucking lyric, and that's that. I feel like that. I feel like, and I'm glad I feel like that. I'd hate to be stuck in stasis in some sort of fixed position. I'm constantly changing my mind. So the real danger of this exercise, whilst doing it live, it's fine. It's not so dangerous. Well, it is in certain respects, in that I could really mess things up or come undone and unglued live. It's not like I'm going out on Radio 1 with Reggie Yates or anything, so it's not that problematic, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't have that much impact. But what was I saying? But there again, that's something else about self-awareness. Just contemplating what you're saying and the impact that will have on chiefly a judgment, not even about who you really are. There's no danger of that coming into question. I like to think I know that. I've got a good firm grasp on that. But just an opinion or something that might be said about me is affected by things I say. And doing this thing where it's recorded, that means it's there for posterity. Historically, it can be looked back upon. And I might say something within these live moments that are no longer true after the fact, even 2 seconds later. And that can be embarrassing, that can be misleading, Like I say, I've got friends who probably have perceptions of me based off things I said years ago, and they haven't seen me since, so they haven't had an opportunity to. I mean, say something in conversation today to someone, I might not necessarily mean it. I think there's a lot of times, and I find us doing this live, to fill dead air, you kind of nervously say anything that comes to you. And I think that happens a lot with people. And it's, again, it's misleading. And I know when I do it, and I can't really go back, and it would be awkward to stop a conversation in a coffee shop and try to explore this with somebody who kind of, you're a casual acquaintance with. Like, you know, I could be sat there having a coffee saying, John Barrowman's fucking cracking, like, you know, a great entertainer. And then inside I'm going, I fucking hate John Barrowman. I don't hate John Barrowman, by the way. That may change, though, mightn't it? But it would then be social suicide, really, to then go, well, hold on, I don't really mean that. Yeah. And then they'll be like, what, sorry? Eh? Well, I said I didn't like, I like John Barrowman, but I don't. All right, so why did you say that? Well, you know, I think life's a process of becoming, like Kierkegaard said, the father of existentialism. I'll get me caught, eh? So, it happens a lot. I find it happening at work. And now I have a self, it's silly me saying self, that's just so dumb. I have an awareness of even my profession. I work in the social sector. I'm a highly responsible job working for disabled kids, adults, who now are termed clients in a shift in social services. We feel it's more empowering to call them clients. It's a little bit jarring for me and a lot of my clients, in fact. We often make jokes about it. And I actually like being one of the clients. Refers to me as home help. I kind of like that. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But that goes into PC right there, which is something, if you are interested in that, read Edward Stoughton's It's a PC World, which I think there's nothing wrong with political correctness at all. It's a considerate, it's an aware, considerate means to be aware of people and their diversity, basically. It's political correctness gone mad. No, it's not. It's just a consideration. That's all it is. And we should have evolved into that, and we should be fine with that by now. What you think is political correctness gone mad, you are conflating with health and safety. So be a bit more aware of the two, and be a bit more considerate about the definitions. You pleb. So saying things out loud, It's a huge risk, and it's something I discussed about Kafka, that he really struggled with in his writing. A lot of it was informed by fear and anxiety, and the desperation that comes from trying to get across these things to people. Like, he could either quit or go on. Kafka went on, was what I read yesterday. You've just got to fucking go on. Got to keep trying. The knockbacks are crushing at times when you meet someone's eyes who you feel like you're wholly connected to. That is an unspeakable, that is a, it's almost an untouchable abstraction, a thing that is innate again in us that we understand is there, but we can't give words to. It's crushing when they betray feelings of misunderstanding. You know, the loneliness that leads to, and then the destruction that leads to. That led me down a path many times, and led me to, I would say it underlined a period in my life that led to a very earnest suicide attempt. Trying to explain to an employer, for instance, something that cannot be touched, something that cannot be proven in the physical world, such as an illness, a disorder like depression, and then make myself vulnerable enough to give access to medical reports, to discussing frankly and openly these ridiculous, in inverted commas, thoughts and emotions, all engineered just so somebody can gain something of a better understanding, so that they, not that they can excuse your behaviour, just so they can understand it. I don't want to be excused. Sometimes it'd just be nice to be understood, especially when you're trying to do a job and you have this gigantic wall within your head preventing that from sometimes happening. You're just trying to, you know, I thought I was doing the right thing, and then you're met with bricks and mortar. Just, and the experience had enough, and you'll shut down. You'll either withdraw, and it makes, I understand why Salinger up sticks and fucked off. I've had this little fantasy of my own of living in a hamlet of about 5 people in a cottage, somewhere in the Shetlands maybe, with a typewriter and a log fire and a border collie. That'll do me. And sometimes I just don't want to participate. Sometimes I can't. I physically can't. That's one of the main aspects of certain depressions. It's not just doom and gloom. It's a very conscript, lazy way to describe depression. It's an all-encompassing illness. It bleeds into so many veins of your life, carried along by yourself. You know, it's self-perpetuating at times. There's a destruction that you just cannot, as if by induction, you just go through. And I've been there. You go through these letdowns and disappointments enough, and these eyes that are sat before you that have no idea what you're on about, and you just realise this is pointless. I must be wrong. Everyone else is right and I'm wrong. Doubt takes root. I must be fucking nuts or stupid. And I never think I'm nuts. You know, I've got a big thing about madness. I've experienced with, like, genuine, not myself, but, you know, like, mental illness to its extremes. And I would never use the term lightly. I think it's almost like this thing about, why can't I think of the acronym? You know, where just illness is sort of appropriated in casual everyday language and conversation. Like, oh, he's mad, him. You know, no, he's not. Like, don't discredit this really serious. If you saw true madness, if you were around it, it's not fucking funny. I know, you know, that it's easy to lampoon loony bins and people who are a bit, you know, you call them a bit dopey or you know, backward or whatever. Or, you know, there's all these horrible terms, but it's not funny. It's like any illness. I mean, I wrote about this maybe 10 years ago at one point, because I've just come off some medication, which was not just for anxiety disorder and depression, it was also for for compulsive disorder, for OCD, and that's now culturally that is so. I mean, I'm not saying I enjoy. I don't suffer from it. I enjoy some of it. Obsessions over numbers and what they amount to. If I total them, say I was going to pull into a numbered parking space, and they'd have to total a certain thing. Things like that. It can make things a little bit, you know, a bit more. If it might be a slow day, and if nothing else, it keeps me arithmetic pretty sharp, which comes in handy when you're an adult. And, you know, people say, oh, he's got OCD, well, Brian, he's always cleaning the pots up after him. Like, that's actually just being tidy. That's all that is. There's a fucking massive, massive difference between a disorder and just being a clean, hygienic person. It's like a base level of hygiene. That's all that is. You should clean your shit up after you. You should wash your hands after you. That's a standard that everyone should meet. A basic standard. It's not OCD. You talk to somebody. I'm not saying talk to me, because I'm not. I'm very mild case. But you know, the people who scrub their hands with bleach, who have to wear gloves when they, you know, touch banisters, the crippling effect that has on their lives. You go talk to them when you throw that around flagrantly, and have a bit more awareness and consideration for that. A lot of my problem with awareness, you know, I said it can be crippling. It certainly is. I mean, doing this alone, the impact that this, thinking about why am I doing this? What's my motivation? I've said in the past I've undertaken things because they might impress somebody or something, you know, on my writing. I was very full of pride for my writing in these magazines and websites. I never phoned it in. I watched a lot of people take a press kit, which a lot of albums come with now, written often by the management of the label, and basically just copy and paste that and maybe change a word at the end. And that's just lazy and irresponsible and not considerate of your output, showing a lack of awareness, I think. All just so they could see the name in print. I enjoyed seeing my name in print, don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with feeling pride for things. I've worked through that in therapy. But for me personally, it was just a very insincere way of exploring feelings. You know, I always try to tie back. I reviewed, say, Alexei Sale at the Stand, and I tied that back to his upbringing was with a communist mother and father. I, tongue-in-cheek, discussed my upbringing with a staunch lefty like my dad, who was on the cusp of signing up for the Red Army, I would say. So I always try to do that, but now I've moved away from that. I just want to deliberately lose touch with these things because they breed an awareness of things that are going on. There was definitely an ease to my creative output when I was switched off from these things. I was able just to put my head down and withdraw inwards to myself, and I could come up with things rather easily at times. And then when you participate, you can get distracted from that. You become too aware of things. Your cheeks become red. And you realise your own folly, become embarrassed by things. I'm always appending sentences. I can't, you know, I often say humble brag now, which I got from Bret Easton Ellis. But even that's like a caveat or a precursor to, why can't I just say, you know, I did this thing and it was all right. There's nothing wrong with that. As long as you're aware that and you don't let it slip into an obnoxious thing or an arrogance or an inconsideration for people around you who might not be having such a good time. You know, it's not so, and that's the danger of things like Facebook, I think. It's either, oh, here I am in the Bahamas whilst I'm sitting, you know, somebody will be sitting in a job they hate, which makes it, you know, not very nice for them. Or it's whinge. And there's nowhere in the middle. So anyway, getting back to this, I mean, self-awareness almost stopped me from doing this immediately. That I read the stats from the previous shows and you know, seeing that quite a lot of people have been downloading the recorded versions and listening back to them gave me an awareness, and it's making me check myself now, what I say and what I do, and that's, it's ruinous, and I don't want to let it get in the way to hamper or hinder this thing, because I'm enjoying it and I think it's worthwhile. But what confounds me and makes me so angry is the paucity of awareness of others, as you've probably gathered from what I've been rambling on about so far. And that was neatly explored in Stuart Lee's How I Escaped My Certain Fate, The Life and Deaths of a Stand-Up Comedian, which is basically it contains transcripts of his shows with annotations of, you know, for each bit he'll annotate and go into it and maybe explain somewhat what his position was on these things. It's really enlightening. He's a very savvy, switched on, very clever guy, and for my money the best stand-up in the world, if I may be so bold. But this is from his 2005 show Stand-Up Comedian, which I think you'll probably find online on the YouTubes or something like that. But he said, again, talking about this idea of lack of awareness, people coming up to me, and it's such a there's so much foolishness in it. This, and I get it at work, and from strangers. It's this idea of where does this familiarity on their behalf to me arrive from? And they feel like some people come up to me and they launch into something about, you know, it might be because it's ubiquitous and it's a huge smokescreen and an agenda of the government. Not to sound like some sort of conspiracy theorist Russell Brand kind type. But it is, to be quite glib about it. You know, the immigration issue is raised just to much like war, to direct us away from the real domestic issues that we should be focusing on. And to Joe Public, the white van man with the tabloid newspaper, it's a convenient issue that they can pour all their hatred into, all their lack of information, all their laziness. It's neatly summarised by a tabloid paragraph written by some monobrowed, hairy pervert. And it's disturbing. It's absolutely, it's horrifying to me. And it happens, you know, people come up to me and they say, people come up to me and say, you know, get them out, bloody, there's no room, man, like, all these, you know, like the deals and all them fields, there's no room, like, you know, whoa, come back to Callier, like, yeah, you dirty bastard. And they, what makes me, there's a few things alarm me about this. One, the familiarity it takes to come up and say something like that to a pretty much a stranger such as me. What is it about me? Chiefly, this is it. I mean, all the, for all I may disagree with them very strongly, it's the idea that something about me betrays this sense that I would agree with them. Being a guy who looks like I do, a foppish kind of specky twat, what am I effusing that gives them the idea that, oh, he's gonna, this will be up his street if I just start saying some jingoistic shit, like, he's gonna be on site for this. Yeah, that bothers me. What am I saying? What is my output? I'm being aware and considerate of future output now, because obviously I'm giving the wrong impression here. What? And the other alarming thing is, I've said before, you sometimes just say things you don't necessarily mean. I experienced this on shift at work. I work 48-hour shifts with sometimes, you know, off, if that was the case, I'd get sleep. Don't worry, I'd have like 6 hours rest. It's not that I'm not a fucking robot. Or I might do a 16-hour stint one day. And when you're with another worker who you don't really know, you just, you know, you're tired, you feel a bit awkward sometimes, and you just fill the gaps. You just say things out loud that you don't necessarily mean. I get that, and I can understand that, but I hate that I do, because I'm almost excusing them for it. And I hate the idea that I'm too logical about things. I'm looking at things from both sides all the time, and I'm empathising with people I actually disagree, but I get it, because we're just people, you know? In my heart, I think I'd prefer to be like this, but then it's a tough one. Like, I kind of wish, because it means I sit on the fence a lot. So I'm able to rationalise too much, and I can't take a hard line on anything. And I feel like a bit of a wet leaf for that. Fish are wet, generally, though. And yeah, that just leads to more doubt and uncertainty, because I can't see anything with great conviction, because I'm thinking, well, the guy who argues with me, this is where he's probably coming from. And I can understand that. So it just gives everything this tinge of uncertainty, and just, I'm not sure of me footing a lot of the time. And this all goes back to not having a reaffirming voice from a young age. You know, I've got abandonment issues there, and then you kind of breed your own inner voice as a counter to that, and it's usually a destructive one. It's usually the critical voice, as it was called in cognitive analytical therapy. I said I did behavioural therapy in previous podcasts. That was a mistake. It was analytical therapy. So I'd analyse thought patterns, behavioural patterns of the past. So I'd go back historically to things I'd done to better understand them, to try and to be circumspect, I guess, to get around them. We call them snags, these hindrances. And I thought that was unique to me. Dad, he'd always feel like, well, Matt, the snag is with these things. And I'd always, like, even when he says it now, I'm like, what the fuck does that mean? Like, nobody says that. But it came up in the realm of psychotherapy, which made us chuckle. But these things that hold me back, being called snags, I then have this word, I have this association with me dad. So it kind of, you know, kind of trivializes these massive things that hold me back in life. So, but that's, you know, that's pretty funny. These things that stop me from going any further with things, like the awareness, that's one big snag. Like, knowing too much in terms of, like, what people might think, or how I'm behaving and how it might be interpreted. That can just stop you from doing so much in life, which is a fucking tragedy. But then there's some people who can just waltz into things, just sleepwalk. I mean, I said about Kafka and the castle, there's this, you know, the idea of being in this strange land and being sucked farther and farther down into this strangeness, this almost distorted reality. That's something I've been exploring in my novel, and the idea of just, I'm tiptoeing around drunks. That's how it feels sometimes. Like, where, what the fuck are you on about, mate? Like, I'm not, I don't think that. Like, I don't know where you're coming from. Everything, like, everyone just seems to be on this other level that I can't quite understand. And that's the hypocrisy here, I guess, is that I'm having a go at these people because I can't understand them. Because they don't necessarily understand me. It's kind of like a mirror there we hold up, a mirror to the heart. I mean, I wrote, you know, I'm self-referential, by golly, but I once wrote, the shame I feel, such a hypocrite, but at least I'm ashamed of it. And that's a double-edged sword as well, that line, but at least I'm ashamed of it. There's a certain tragedy to that line and a certain victory in it, I think. And so many people aren't there. They aren't ashamed of things. And they come to me with these opinions and posit these things as if I'm going to agree with them as a means to sort of bond with me, to break the ice. And that alarms me because if it's a racial thing, which it tends to be, I'm not coming from there at all. And you're actually making me feel uncomfortable. It gives me an ugly feeling inside. And there's a pall immediately hangs upon our environs because of that. And that's all you're doing. You're putting me in that position. You're putting me... I'm in a bind then, because then I've got to react somehow and I've got to deal with that feeling. And I can either sell myself out and sort of laugh, and then that leads to me feeling like a cheapened, weak, pathetic idiot, or I can stand up to you, but that puts me in the position of then having to, facing conflict, and it's not fucking fair, really. And this is another thing, I mean, I have to learn to say no in life. I'm being told that now, and I feel like I would do anything to appease people. I mean, I wouldn't... I've been told I'm too much of a people pleaser. I think I am. You know, I'm trying to get away from that in life. But there's a beauty in living your life like that, with an openness and a willingness to... a readiness to please. There's a fine line between being mugged off or mad dogged, as Tuco from Breaking Bad might say it. But it's a fine line between that and just being a nice. I don't need to be nice, you know, like Clementine says in Eternal Sunshine for the Spotless Mind. I don't need myself to be it. I don't need others to be it to me. It's just such a generic, shitty adjective. Like, I'm way more than lovely or nice. But you know, saying that, I will tell you that I like to make people feel comfortable. Even if I have my worst enemy over the coals, I had them by bang to rights, completely clamped. I wouldn't capitalise on that, I don't think. I hate that kind of twist and contort in the face of seeing them struggle. I feel embarrassed for them. I'd probably, you know, if I was in a fight with somebody, not physical, I mean like a debate, I'd probably want to wrap them up and bring them some ice cream or something. You know, I wouldn't want to make them feel bad if I was in the right and I was able to win that argument. It would just embarrass me. And they probably say, "No, isn't he lovely?" I'm not saying that. I'm not lovely. I'm not. I'm really, you know, I'm dark, mysterious, and pissed off. But this is the thing about about getting older as well. You know, your ideals are said to soften along with your belly and your head, and it's hard to cling on to them and be so convinced of them, and. It's just a weird, it's like that, I've gone beyond the formative stage now, and I'm at this weird crux, you know, the 29, where you've already, you're already dealing with becoming 30. It's a new epoch in your life, and it's just strange trying to hold on to certain things, but then trying to explore and develop into other realms. And I mean, that's like a huge, that's something I'm preoccupied with, yet my frustration is a lot of people are just not there at all. Not even, I mean, people who are three times my age and they're still stuck in the same spot. And yet I'm destroying myself, with anxiety, like poring over these things, and I just feel this kind of I just feel like this righteous indignation about it all, I guess. Like, oh fuck, why aren't you feeling as bad as I do? How come you seem so happy, even though it, and ignorance is bliss. There's a lot in that. But anyway, Stuart Lee, I've only got 10 minutes left, so let's go to Stuart Lee. He goes over this in his stand-up comedian 2005 show. Here we go. Where was it? Yeah. Okay, but you do meet people who have very fixed notions about other groups of people. I'll give you an example of what I mean. I got in a cab in London in December, and about 5 minutes into the journey, apropos of nothing, early on a Sunday morning, the cab driver turned round to me and said, I think all homosexuals should be killed. This actually happened to Stuart. In his annotated notes, this is what he says. He says, this actually happened to me in the summer of 1999 as I pulled off the West Way towards BBC TV Centre in a car that had been booked by the BBC. If you're driving someone to the liberal bastion of the BBC, it's reasonable to assume they won't think all homosexuals should be killed. And of course, there's always the high statistical chance that your passenger will themselves be gay. Where did the comment spring from? Was there something on the radio that I didn't hear, or a billboard I didn't see that provoked it? Also, why say it at all? Even from a business point of view, it can't make sense for a service provider to risk causing such massive offence. Why are cab drivers not concerned about appearing to fulfil completely their stand-up comedy stereotype? It's almost as if they enjoy it. Yeah, case in point. And, you know, if I was in the service, it's tantamount to me serving somebody a coffee and going, I think the Serbs should just be called because I hate their haircuts. It's just shows such a complete fundamental lack of awareness. And it's dumb, basically, especially in that context. If you're serving somebody from a business point of view, I don't know. Anyway, it goes on to say, it gets even better, that after a moment he said, well, because, I know it's through that, and then there was a pause, because he's not, oh, there we go. So Stuart said, now, whatever you think of that, Glasgow, as a statement, you have to admit it's a bold opening conversational gambit. You know, with a stranger. And I was a bit taken aback. I went, oh, why do you think that? And then there was a pause, because obviously he'd never had to go to the next level of the argument, fraternising mainly with cab drivers. And he said, well, after a moment he said, well, because homosexuality is immoral. And I said, and this is honestly true, I said, I'm not sure how much weight you can afford to place on the notion of morality in this argument, because morality's not a fixed thing. It changes its parameters culturally, historically, over time. I said, for example, look at ancient Greece. To this day, we still take most of our most fundamental principles about ethics, aesthetics, philosophy, medicine, science, whatever, from ancient Greece. And yet, I said, in ancient Greece, love between two men, far from being immoral, was actually considered the highest, most ethical, most profound, if you will, most moral form of love there could be. So all I'm saying, I said to him, is I'm not sure how useful morality is, given its flexible nature, as a cornerstone of your argument on this subject. And then he said to me, he said, well, you can prove anything with facts, can't you? And then the annotated, I mean, that's just hilarious. Like a lot of Stuart's stuff, it's intelligent, and within the context, it's tragic comedy to me. My favourite comedy. Along with Blick comedy. It's all Blick! That one's for you again, Gary. Now, his annotation said, I did honestly say something along these lines at this point, but even as I was saying it, I passed a point where I was aware it had been an absurd decision to try and reason with the man, and so just went for broke, going on and on and on, past the point of no return, enjoying the futility of it. And that's how I feel sometimes. You have to make a game out of these things, just for your own personal enjoyment, almost like a social science experiment, like a situationalist thing, a Guy Debord thing. That's for you, Polly. Well, you just make a game out of it because there's no point otherwise. And when you realise there's no point in trying to get across your feelings about something, then you just want to retreat and not participate anymore. And that's the great, I think that's a great tragedy right there. And something I really wrestle with a lot. So yeah, these people who just seemingly think, I don't know, like I can't beautiful moment again to reference Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Spike Jones does him, Charlie Kaufman, you know, all those people in that corner, Dave Eggers, a lot of things. There's this great one of the moments that I really loved in that film was when Jim Carrey is constantly berated for mumbling by Clementine in public generally, and that's something I struggled with through my teens. Like, I would mumble and mumble and mumble, and I guess I still do sometimes. It's because I'm embarrassed. Like, I assume everyone around me is this, like, is a professor or a dean or something, and whatever I'm talking on, they're gonna, you know, someone with a big nose is gonna come out and point out my mistakes and actually find me, suss me out. I'm gonna be found out to be the fraud that I know I am, and I mumble. You know, I think I'm so aware of people around me and who they might be. And often I have this this fear, like we said yesterday, Idris Parry said, the fear might just be born of things that don't really represent what the actual circumstance. You know, it's not really representational. It's a distortion. I just assume it's an assumption, and it makes an ass out of you and me. It's an assumption that everyone's better than me, that everyone I walk down the street and interact with or pass is some sort of intellectual and doyen, and that's ridiculous. I mean, some may be, but this is what I mean about awareness. It would ruin my communicative skills, my how to express myself, and that can feed into this. You know, I might think somebody's out there who's far smarter than me, because those people exist. They always will. They always do. Just laughing, you know, thinking what a moron. But that goes back to the idea of partly why I'm doing this, to make myself vulnerable. To what end? To promote my new album, The Dead Sea Tapes, available now. www.nobodysaysthatanymore. That was one dot, not two. markjameshammond.bandcamp.com. You can stream that now. You can download a digital copy. I will need your email address because I want to send you a link to a video of the live performance I did of most of those songs recently, and a bunch of handwritten shit that you can do what you want with, a lot of words and stuff. But yeah, why do I do it? I don't know. Because it makes me feel a bit better. You know, I'm going to wrap this up in a minute. I'm going to feel much better. I'm going to go about my day feeling like I've done something. I've used my time all right. I haven't really wasted it, although I've done this twice today. But you know what? I've done it now. It's done. It's over. Spilt milk. Move on. All I know is I'll probably be hanging out with friends later, and I'll just be closed-lipped because I've spoken at length today, and they'll probably think I'm an arrogant, ignorant twat. But that I'm sure that perception already exists without my input. So I'm going to go now. I think this version 2, it was a lot more upbeat than the last one, a bit more angry and a bit more righteous, but that's who I was in the last hour, and I'm sure I'll be someone else in the next. Next, I don't know, I'm going to Paris in a couple of days. I might cast from there if I can. I'd like to do it with my brother, because I know he's been wanting to do podcasts for a while, and it would be fun if we could do it. So probably do that, and I want to get more into the album, because like I say, it's out now, but I need to finalise some things about getting physical copies made and so forth, so it's still very much in progress. I want to discuss that more, discuss my studies more, and just keep checking in, keep this up, because I seems to be getting a good response. I'm just licking some peanut butter off me middle finger there. Right, we've got about a minute now, and I said before, because I was quite sad into things, I said to cheer yourself up, go and watch some stuff on YouTube. I'm going to recommend that stuff again, because I think it's great. Me and Roy watched it yesterday and had tears in my eyes. The Planet Rock profiles of Shirley Bassey and Tom Jones. Go and look for that on YouTube, darling. And then have a look for the literal music video for A Heart's Take on Me and for Total Eclipse of the Heart. Have a chuckle over that. Yeah, I'm going now. I'm going to do something. I might go for a run, do something that's going to clear the cobwebs furthermore, so I can be a better person, whatever that means. I don't know. What does that mean? How about you comment in the comment section? What's being a better person mean to you? Does it mean expounding on a bunch of shit on a live podcast in a very self-righteous way? Because to me it does. So yeah, go and have fun, and take care of yourselves.
and each other. Good night and good luck.